This is Camille Kajiri, and you're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. And so you should. Keep your finger on the button and don't stop listening, because there's nothing better anywhere else.
This is Gallifrey Public Radio, a weekly podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of Doctor Who. We travel through classic and new episodes, explore the extended universe, and play a few games from time to time. We do discuss news, content that has been officially released, and the occasional interesting rumor, but we'll warn you before anything considered spoilers comes up. Welcome to episode 423 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where in the next 198,000 years, the media still can't be trusted, and the junk food vendors won't change much either. Leave it to a click of the fingers and some properly distributed air conditioning to reset the fourth great and bountiful human empire. I'm Kier.
I'm Haley.
I'm Jay.
And I'm Julie. This week, we spike into our deemed worthwhile stream to find the positives in Doctor Who stories that got a lukewarm reception, applying it this time to the early New Who era Doctor Who episode, The Long Game. The Ninth Doctor, Rose, and Adam travel to Satellite 5 in the year 200,000, where the human race needs a little course correction.
So we've done close to about a half a dozen of these deemed worthwhile looks at often maligned episodes. And while I grabbed this one from what is categorically towards the bottom 10th of the composite list, you know, sort of the meta review list, if you put it all together, this was one that, just by the name and even by the quick description, a lot of us couldn't remember exactly which one this was, myself included, a lot of the details, other than the fact that, oh, it had Adam in it. Right. So, given just that, where we leapt off from last week and trying to remember which one this was, Haley, how long did it take you to sink back in and say, oh, okay, it was that episode?
I mean, I think all I actually remembered of the episode at all was like the forehead thingies, and I don't think I remembered anything else about it.
Really? Okay. All right.
Also, Adam was only in two episodes, right? And this was the second one?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Didn't really like him in either, but we'll get to that. Jay, did this one click back in, or was it one that you kept sort of intentionally forgetting over the years?
Oh no, I actually remembered this one fairly well. I had most of it on lock, but I will say that it was interesting because just, I mean, 30 minutes ago I was talking to my fiance and she was like, what are you guys talking about tonight? And I brought it up, and I'm like, there's this, and there's that, and it's Simon Pegg, and the Jaggerfest, and this, that, and the other. And she's like, I don't know. I was like, it's the one with Adam, and the opening thing in the forehead. She goes, oh, yeah, that one.
That's pretty much the defining moment. You take a little bit of bad CGI, and it just locks it into your memory.
Mm-hmm.
So, Julie, I know we started discussing this as we were trying to look it up and say, all right, did it come before or after this point in the first season, that sort of thing? Did it lock in pretty quickly for you once we started into, oh, Satellite 5, oh, news editing, or...
Nope. I was still waiting for the game show to show up. I think because of the overall up in the satellite media perspective, I was still waiting for the other episode to be this one.
Right.
But I also do remember outside of the forehead finger snap thing at the end. I didn't really remember the beginning of that being there, but I remembered someone having it when they shouldn't have.
How we got to that point.
Yeah, but I also remembered the frozen bodies, but I didn't remember until I saw them again that they were up there, and that was a. But I remember thinking like that would really suck to have that happen to you, thinking you're going to this great place and then like, are you alive or are you not? I don't know. She saved them a little at the end. I know I'm getting into it. But
we're going to parse all this. Yeah. You slow your roll for a sec.
So those are the things. It was a very partially rememberable episode for me.
Okay. So Julie's done talking for the episode, so I'll talk to the rest of you about what you think.
No, I got stuff to say.
All right. Let's probe a little deeper.
This is fascinating. Satellite 5 contains every piece of information within the fourth great and bountiful human empire. Birth certificates, shopping habits, bank statements. But you two, you don't exist. It's not a trace. No birth, no job, not the slightest kiss. How can you walk through the world and not leave a single footprint?
Suki! Hello. Can you hear me? Suki! What have you done to her?
I think she's dead.
She's working.
They've all got chips in their head and the chips keep going. Like puppets.
Oh! You're full of information. But it's only fair we get some information back because apparently you're no one. It's so rare not to know something. Who are you?
It doesn't matter because we're off. Nice to meet you.
So this was actually RTD's own script. He wrote this one. So this was the kind of campy fun that he wanted to hand his viewers in his first outing bringing this show back. But we are, I think, this was like episode 8 or so? 8 or 9?
7.
In the first? 7,
yeah.
Yeah, so we're past the midpoint. So we had well established a relationship with Doctor and Rose at this point, really starting to get to know 9 pretty well. And they had some sort of come off the heels of Dalek, right? Mm. So as far as just the plot itself, this idea of taking this quick trip into the distant, distant, distant future, which he's done with Rose before, and now taking it as a, hey, Rose, why don't you take the driver's seat for a second and make all knowledgeable-like on this noob and see how you like it?
Mm-hmm.
So overall, like the story, are there some aspects of the story itself in its execution that really shine for you, even though it got panned quite a bit when it was airing.
I did like that little moment between 9 and Rose where he's like giving her the quick bullet points so then she can be the smart one. Like, that was a nice little thing, and it's a shame that the episode peaked so early.
Huh, okay. So yeah. Haley's really going to help with the whole deemed worthwhile thing going on. I get that.
I liked that Rose then rolled into this next room, which I will let the doctor explain.
Right. I did like that.
Yeah. Russell definitely understands what he wants the character interchange and interaction to be, particularly with his two primaries. But I think it's commendable that so early in, it wasn't perceived at the time, but to us looking back on it, the first season out of now, coming up on 13 of these, that he feels comfortable having this funky future romp with a new character. This is like the curly-haired cousin that kind of comes in at some point late in the show, but it's not late in the show at all. Like, you're introducing this new character that could potentially is like, for all intents and purposes, being groomed as a new companion because he's begging to be one. Mm-hmm. And we get to try to figure this out. We learn very, very quickly that he's got ulterior motives. He's a greedy little SOB. So I don't know. I think that's a calculated risk to take with a show this early, and it works.
Yeah, I did like, for what he was worth, I liked the Adam character. I liked the foil to Rose and that she's very loyal, and he was immediately, I have a way to do this. And he was crafty enough to, on his own, sort of figure his way into having the knowledge from this future time zone.
Mm.
And I thought that was a very fun thing to play with. And then I liked that it showed the doctor just shutting that down and saying, no way, that's against what we do here and what I stand for. So I did like that, those themes coming out of this episode.
I really liked it, but I wish, as much as we apparently don't like Adam, I wish it had happened after a couple episodes of him like becoming part of the family, and then there's a betrayal, and it's got a little more weight to it, as opposed to, oh, the new guy's a jerk.
But if you're a jerk, you're a jerk, right? Jerk's if you were going to do it, the first opportunity you get, it's going to happen.
Yeah, he sort of wears his jerkiness on his sleeve there.
Won't even drink the beef smoothie.
No. Could have been really good.
Why too. Would you not?
Right? Try all the things in the new...
Rose doesn't even flinch either. She tastes it and goes, beef? Hands it over.
Well, to that point, though, living... Or not living, but traveling with the doctor means that you have to be open to those sort of experiences. Mm-hmm. And Rose never really... She wants to call home and she feels connected back to Earth, but she doesn't need that. And she doesn't have that homesickness, which Adam showed from the very first instance. He's been gone, what, 5 hours? And he's like, well, I've gone traveling and I don't know what to do.
I would say that that's not exactly true because, I mean, the whole scene when the doctor, you know, upgrades Rose's phone was because of the same kind of thing where she was like everyone I know is dead. I'm, you know, like it's all gone and this, that, and she starts to have that kind of freak out, the same thing that Adam did. And Rose was able to just pull out the phone and be like, here, call him, because she had been through that same situation. So while she has moved past that and understands the situation better now, I wouldn't necessarily ding Adam for it because it was the exact same scenario.
I also noticed that specifically with Adam, it's a clever writing gimmick, convention, writing convention.
good catch.
To start feeding this information to him as a means of, we're going to guide you through this. I'm going to hold your hand. I'm going to teach you what you need to know. And even down to the physical placement of the here, hold on to the TARDIS key, so that all of this stuff can be siphoned out of him as the tee up to the big bad's insurgents, right? Mm-hmm. You kind of feel like it's like they're handing him an awful lot of information. How's he processing all this? How's he taking this all in when they're just handing him one massive revelation about the expanses of time and space after another? And you could see at a certain point he's kind of goggling at it, right? But his subconscious is locking it all away. I never give Adam enough, or I never give him credit enough to be able to take that all in at face value and just handle it. I just don't think his character was meant to be quite that sharp. Mm-hmm. But his brain picks it up.
Right.
So, yeah, being able to draw that back out, however that brain spike works, I don't know. I know, but yes. So I can literally see your gray matter. Does that mean that the data gets in? I'm sure it's all fascinating technology. As far as 9, who we haven't really got to see, we haven't collectively watched a Ninth Doctor episode in a long time.
Yeah.
So
I don't know.
Felt good to get back in those shoes, right?
Oh yeah, I missed this Doctor. I really did.
Which is why I'm really glad that he's been, like, the news cycle's been carrying a lot with him, and he's been talking a lot because of the release of the Ninth Doctor audio adventures and stuff, so he's sort of back in the groove and all. But, yeah, I mean, at this point, this was even specifically here at this, just about middle of the first season, he's enjoying travel again. Mm-hmm. You know, that some of that dark brooding baggage is not out of his hands, but it's at least sort of set down just behind him a little.
It's got wheels.
Yeah. He's got it on a little pull. Yeah, it's pull luggage rather than, you know, strapped to his back. So which makes all the exchanges with Rose so great, even down to the when he's like digging through all the bowels of the satellite and whatnot. And he's like, look at Rose. Rose asks all the right questions. I thank you. You know, she's really, she takes to it. You know, they got this great riff.
Yeah.
I miss that a lot. A lot. But what about our supporting characters? What about everybody else that's in the mix here? I mean, Adam aside. But we've got a handful of others. We've got,
right, we've got Kafka.
Our two journalists. And
Suki.
Yeah.
Suki, not Suki.
Suki, not nope, Suki. Right. Well, okay. Suki, freedom fighter, Suki.
Suki, freedom fighter, who I do not fault her for when being faced with the Jagrafess's teeth, was like, oh no, just froze.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah, no.
I've been trained to take down people in like guerrilla warfare and whatnot, and I can go, you know, hide, you know, in shrapnel flying, but no, not that. That's a lot of teeth.
That has too many teeth, and it is above my head, and I'm just going to scream at it. Yep.
Checks out. Yeah.
Checks out. Yeah.
And I think one of the unsung heroes in this entire story is the nurse.
She just took all that man's money and gave him all those upgrades.
Oh, yeah.
So, for those unfamiliar with the short-lived, ran for three seasons, BBC comedy series Black Books, this same actor played Fran. She was a great character. She was just a ball of neuroses and whatnot, and she's a tremendously fun actor to watch. But she takes this simple role. You know, you're supposed to be a nurse that's, like, upselling. You know, oh, you've got enough credit? Oh, you can get the deluxe package here. Vomit ice cubes and blah, blah, blah. And just rolls with it. It's so much fun to watch. But I ask about our baddies because we're being handed the star talent in this one is Simon Pegg, who isn't even your primary villain. He turns out to be a glorified henchman.
Yeah, but he's the only one who speaks Geographessian.
Geographinese.
Which the TARDIS did not translate for us.
Maybe there's a certain degree, like you get down low enough on the sentient scale. I don't know. I think it's good, though, that you can't understand.
No, I agree. I think it allows Simon to actually be the spokesperson.
Yeah. Getting the one side of the conversation. Oh, no, of course. Of course, yes.
Try it again. Double check. Triple check.
I loved him. He was just the right level of smarmy kind of like, it's like, no, I work for a consortium of banks. I am the face of this. And it was just, he was so slimy, but not in a way that you couldn't enjoy it.
Yeah. It wasn't for personal gain. He was just, he was a good company man through it all.
And he's not evil for the sake of it. He's just doing the things, just doing the job.
He's aware that the entity is evil, but hey, everybody's got to earn a paycheck.
Yeah. Yeah. He reminded me of a more charming Smithers from The Simpsons.
So you consider Smithers to be more charming than the editor?
No. The editor is the more charming. He's a more charming version of Smithers.
I guess? I don't know. I guess it depends on how you perceive the charm. Because, I mean, it's he never leaves that control room. He's surrounded by zombies.
He may leave it. You just don't know that.
I don't know.
He's got some swanky little room off to the side that no one sees.
His own personal little heat source. He's just got a little kerosene space heater in there.
He's got a sharp black suit.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
No, he just carries around those little hand warmer pads. He's got pockets inside his coats that just keep him.
Right.
Those things are crucial.
Yeah.
As far as Kathaka being the consummate journalist, right, being the key to sort of opening this all up as she's eavesdropping on Nine and Rose. Does that all flow pretty comfortably for you as far as, you know, she just happens to be, you know, working her way, finally figures out how to break in to get up to the, you know, floor 500 and do all this just to catch that information and feels it's within her duty. She seemed like up through the vast majority of the episode, she was just out for herselfer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, rather than saving her own skin or doing something that might benefit her, she decides she's going to go the high road.
I didn't take her as necessarily an out for herself. She was that, but she was also follow the rules because these are the rules.
Right.
Well,
go ahead.
I was going to say, I mean, she wasn't necessarily like strictly out for herself, but you can tell that that's where her priority was because, you know, Suki, who up to this point we saw them like being friendly and like they got along. And then as soon as Suki gets promoted, before her, she's instantly like, how could you? I've been here and like, you know, turns on her on a dime. So clearly she has her own self-interest at heart.
Right.
At least to start out.
In that culture, in that society though, that's the type of person they want.
Oh, right. They've bred that.
Yeah. Because it's been 90 years and she's what, like 20 at the most? Mm-hmm. So she's not out of place, but then she does do the right thing and she helps a little bit, but fights them because these are the rules and they're going to find out. And I just want to get promoted. And she definitely believes in the gold floor.
Yeah. Here's a thought, though. I'm just trying to, I'm seeing whether or not this actually tracks. What if her decision to push the information back out, or to feed the stream with what she's learned, is done so that maybe there still is a bit of the self-gratification and self-reward in that, because she feels like she's going to be the voice of the revolution.
Oh yeah, she broke the story. Everything's going to report.
Yeah, she wants the byline on this.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I kind of took it as a, you know, she did. She followed the rules. She did everything she was supposed to. And when she finally got there, she realized that everything she'd been working towards was a lie. And, you know, the doctor was able to, you know, kind of give her the hints and push her in the right direction to actually do something good and, you know, fight against the, you know, the dishonesty she'd been fed her whole life.
It's an interesting statement, just aside, you know, take it from a pretty high level, just the message that's being conveyed about manipulation of media. I mean, they run in a pretty wild direction with it, but at the core of it, it seems like Davies is kind of making a bit of a backhand statement about the fact that, you know what, your information has been massaged by so many people with self-interests that you really need to start questioning it more often, which is at the timeless bit of advice, but he just takes it to a 200 millennia extreme.
Yeah,
I don't know necessarily if the doctor's statement that it blew up, humanity's going to correct itself, 90 years off course, it'll all work out just
right
fine.
Because he gave the true knowledge to one human too, where he's just sort of thinking that this is enough. I've done the help the man fish. Now he can go fishing all the time.
Right. Well, and not necessarily that it's going to correct itself right away, but over the course of a few hundred years, like, they'll get back on track.
Yeah. It weathers down.
Long enough time scale, it all works out.
It only took 90 years for them to get this far off course. So,
right.
Which I was surprised he spotted it over like a 90 year difference. When you're talking about a scale of like at least 200,000 years, you can notice a 90-year difference in societal development.
I mean, that's the doctor, though. Like, he can tell what decade he's in by tasting the air. It's just, he knows.
It's true. Yeah.
And I think, though, it was that the expectation he had when they landed and he checked everything out was this fine dining and everyone's so nice.
Yeah, this cultural renaissance.
Cultural renaissance. There's all different types of aliens that should be here. And there was none of it. So that's what I think the moment that he was like, whoa, 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 was the junk food and the the lunch horn that rang. And
well, you brought up what I think is what I consider to be one of the most poignant aspects of the story. And that has to do with the, I guess you'd call it xenophobia, or sort of the exclusion of any of the alien races present on this, what is supposed to be this this interplanetary or possibly cross-galactic broadcast source for information. And he keeps saying, where are all the alien life forms that are supposed to be here? And she goes through, you know, Kathika goes down this long list of things about, oh, you know, there was this, and then there was this, and then there was this incident. So, I don't know, it just kind of happens over time. That in and of itself, I thought, was one of the most powerful statements in the whole story, because it rings so true to this very moment.
And it's just like current modern day type stuff where you get a soundbite and that's the only thing you remember about something that might have been, maybe there were two sides to it, or it wasn't so black and white, and all you've got is the, well, this happened and they were bad.
Carefully curated
media
output. Yeah, the peephole view of the fuller picture, yeah.
But we did get a nice little tidbit about the face of Bo is announcing pregnant. He's pregnant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't pick up on that the first time around because I just never I don't know if I paid attention to those types of things back in the day, and now I know that.
I remember might be it, little... but I don't remember it being in this episode, because again, I don't remember this episode. But I do remember that being a thing that we heard about, was that the face of Bo was pregnant.
Yeah. Love celebrations.
To be honest, though, I mean, if it's going to happen to anybody, you sleep around that much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, with aliens who the male of the species carries the baby.
Something's going to impregnate you.
Yeah.
You can't put your bits near other bits that many times without getting something in your bits.
It's true. It's very true.
Speaking of bits, any other elements of the episode that you think are kind of, you know what, I'm really glad I got a chance to catch that moment again, even if I didn't remember it was in this one.
Just the doctor poking fun at Rose about her first date and this, that, and the other, and like, you know, when Adam fainted and he was just like, that's your boyfriend. And Rose just instantly like, not anymore. Like, just, yeah. The banter between the two of them was perfect in this episode. And it reminds me why I love this pairing so much.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I do say though, that this meant that this was the, on a break with Mickey period.
Yeah.
This was not my favorite. I didn't like Mickey's treatment.
Yeah. We've talked about that though.
Yeah. So. Glad Adam got the shove back, like grabbed like the back of his coat in a wad and just walking him into the TARDIS door.
That poor dog.
Yeah,
just leaving messages, and the dog's all excited to hear this voice.
Someone's not paying attention to the dog now. As the answering machine gets increasingly like freaked out.
Notice when it comes time to dump Adam, Doctor nails the landing time. Like, perfect.
I say, that's, but the TARDIS is driving.
Who doesn't visit home for 6 months, though, and then goes to space and is like, I gotta call my mom.
He was in a bunker. Like, I mean, think about the episode before this. Like, he was working for Van Staten, so he probably didn't have a lot of freedom to call home. From a mile underground.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe he called his mom every night from the bunker. We don't know his life.
He just never went home.
Yeah.
Because look how overbearing that mom was.
True. Very true.
Couldn't give him a moment's peace.
Yeah. Oh, well, you know, it's been, time just goes like.
Yeah. Nice little button to end the episode on, too. Yeah. That's a good one.
That might be one of my favorite moments of the episode. Because you knew it was coming, but she took a long time to get there.
Oh yeah. you gotta drag that gag out.
Mm-hmm.
Telegraph it, but don't pay off just yet, for sure. Right. For sure. I don't know. So I mean, in general, do you think this the one? I know Haley's response to this already, but do you think this one deserves all the sort of the milk toast response that it got when it aired and in subsequent DVD releases?
I don't think it's a terrible episode. Like, I think we've seen worse episodes, but it's not particularly memorable. It doesn't have a whole lot going for it that it's like, that's that episode. You need to watch this one because of this reason. Like, I completely forgot that the Jagrafess was the monster, and I was thinking, like, a more memorable villain was the big bad. Like, I thought it was, like, the Daleks or Davros or something.
Mm.
Well, and part of it, I think, is the fact that we revisit Satellite 5, and it is the Daleks at that point, and it's, you know, that kind of muddies the waters a little bit. But I think for this episode, I think it was a good episode. I think that it was, I think Simon Pegg was grossly underused, but I do think that unfortunately, like, it is kind of forgettable, and the things that really stick into your head are the bits with Adam, and that just leaves a bad taste in your mouth. So I think the whole episode is tainted by that.
Well, that's par for the course, though. If you sit down and you go through some form of entertainment, and it's got its highs and its lows, and its lows are ones that just leave you just pushing back and saying, "God, for crying out loud!" You use the taste in your mouth analogy. That's what lingers.
Yeah.
You could have a real nice dessert, but if dinner was bitter, if that keeps coming back, you know, I get it.
But For me, I think that it's one of those episodes where we only have so few with the Ninth Doctor that I would say watch them all, because
you're gonna miss him.
Yeah, and when you get to the regeneration, you're gonna say, "Where's my doctor? Who is this person?" And then you know you grow to love that person too.
Right.
But for that point though, I think it's worth including in any sort of you should watch them.
Well, plus it sets up the other Satellite 5 episode.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
And an interesting romp in and of itself. Mm-hmm. It's also a matter of the relativity of saying, all right, if some of the rankings that went into this ending up where it did was because of viewer satisfaction indexes, right? Or viewer experience indexes, depending on whatever you call it. Maybe that is being viewed within the encapsulation of just the Ninth Doctor stories, right? So
something has to be lower down.
Right. So you say, all right, if this happens to be, just for the sake of the argument, this is the least enjoyable or the least really, really entertaining, however you want to tip the scale, of the Ninth Doctor stories, all things being relative, maybe that means that it still sits well above some stinkers in 10 or 11 or 12. Well, you know, so... I don't know. I don't think it deserves to get shellacked or anything. But I don't know. I guess I'd put it more towards the middle of the pack because of just what Haley said. It's not a bad story at all. It's just not a gem. And we want all our Ninth Doctor memories to be gems. So. I mean,
we only have so much memory. They can't all be memorable. So, you know, there's going to be some forgettable ones in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all right.
Charming.
We'll go review this one again in like 8 years. It's going to be new to us again.
I could already tell after watching this episode last night. I was like, I'm going to forget this one again in a week.
But you know what you'll remember? Beef smoothies.
Well, it's just because I'm having it for dinner.
Throw up ice cubes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, vomit ice cubes in a beef smoothie. That's, yeah.
It's good. That's why the opener said junk food stays the same.
There you go. When we were speaking last week, we were saying happy birthday to Peter Davison because he had turned, this milestone year, 70 years old. Hooray! Well, then a couple days pass and a flood more birthdays come rushing through. This is a very Whovian birthday month.
Yes.
Very. So
is that why we're not on the show? Because we weren't born in April?
I guess.
Yep, that's the only reason.
Yeah. Gotta go back in time and fix that.
Yeah. There are actually 26 people in the UK. 12 of them were born in April, and they all work for Doctor Who.
Yes.
Yeah. So David Tennant turned 50. Only 50.
Hmm.
This is what's weird about this to me. You look at him and say, oh, 50, that's great. Okay, well, that's... Well, do you feel like, oh, God, I feel so old because David Tennant is 50? Or is it right about, you know what? Yeah. Okay, he's 50. Because he looks like he's 40 all the time. And, with a neck beard, depending on whether or not he shaves the neck beard. That's true. But he's like... He's one of those faces that you can never really tell how old he is. So if someone tells you, oh, by the way, he just turned 50, you think, oh, okay, now I have some way to be able to categorize that person's age in my brain.
50 sounds about right to me, though, because the way he looks now and the way he looked when he filmed this stuff that we go back and watch and I say, oh, baby face Tennant, time has passed. So, yes, it makes sense.
You look at what 15 years can do. 15 years of a lot of roles and a lot of sort of manipulating himself physically for roles. He's done a lot of dramas where he had to be very, gaunt and haggard and things like that. And then he had to be youthful and things, or he had to be a freaking demon for a while or whatever. So, I don't know. See him at neutral, which I guess the most neutral we've seen him lately is in... staged, right?
Yeah.
No makeup, or any makeup that's being done is not being done by a professional because it's probably just Georgia in their flat doing his makeup.
Probably, yeah.
Those are my hair goals in real life, though. So I just...
His hair is fabulous.
I was told I was not allowed to purchase the headbands, though. Those hair bands.
Because he probably got them from Georgia's box of stuff she wore in the 90s.
No, the 90s are coming back. It's like we're on the border of the 80s and 90s. That's fashion now, guys.
I need one of those accordion hair bands. Yeah, I got like five of them in that box.
What? They keep your hair out of your face. The best.
But we also had David Bradley's birthday. We just today had Louise Jameson's birthday. There are a few others in the mix that actually, they've just been all flying Kadoori. Past. Yes, Camille Kadoori shares same birthday. Oddly enough, or maybe not so oddly enough. That must have been really weird in the set.
Cake for everybody, except for
me.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there are other people who also work on the show, so there might have been other birthdays in and or around this.
Just an endless sea of cake.
Yeah, well, that when you... Yeah.
That sounds about right for craft services. That's my understanding.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so any day you go by the commissary, there's always a cake there. Who's today? Oh, these 19 people. Oh, okay.
We can tell that you haven't worked in an office for a while. Let's just say that.
No.
I think we had more cake when I worked in retail than now that I work in an office. It just seemed like there was always cake in the break room. Help that we made cakes there.
Yeah. So you could just say, on the cake scale, from a scale of work at home to a major retail environment with hundreds of employees and a company that wants to recognize everybody's birthday, where are you on the cake scale?
So I'm going to start asking that at job interviews. Like when at the end, they're like, do you have any questions for us? What's your cake frequency?
Do you like group up cakes and just put like nine people's name on
it? Is it like that, oh, here's the September birthdays, or are we like a cake for everybody?
That's the worst.
Yeah.
How do you reward me having been born and gracing this place with my presence?
Are you going to put my name up on the Jumbotron in the cafeteria?
How do you handle weekend birthdays?
Do I get to celebrate it on Friday and on Monday?
All right, so back to our second news story.
I don't really want to talk about the second news story because it involves the Dangenda.
Well, it does kind of, but not like a whole lot of news, really. So John Bishop was on the Graham Norton show and talking about a Q&A session that he was a part of. And of course, the topic came up of like, can you tell us anything about your character from Doctor Who? You know, like, where does he come from? And his response was, well, where do you think he comes from? Have a guess. You know, it's like, I am who I am. Like, I'm not going to play Tom Cruise. And the internet does what the internet does and figures out, okay, so clearly this character's from Liverpool.
Which means, ipso facto, they must be filming in Liverpool because they're going to have to pick him up there. And we want it to be accurate. So everybody go look for set production and let's go blah, 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 blah.
And he says that the BBC, they called him up and said, you broke the cardinal sin. You told them something about Doctor Who. And he's like, I didn't tell them anything.
They're supposed to live in darkness for 10 months at a time, not knowing what's going on with the show. That's how we do this.
But I mean, Whovians are what Whovians are, and they are going to just take whatever you give them and run with it. So now there's this run on Liverpool and everybody looking for that kind of connection, and
Dan, you have more to live up to now. Right. This has to be so much more worth it. Just saying, if you want to come on here and just let us know.
I'm not sure that it helps or harms the Dan mystery to know that he's a Liverpudlian.
Oh, it doesn't matter to me in any way. I'm just saying, now he has more to live up to. He's, rules are rules, man, and you broke them.
Yeah, just proves you're not right for the job. Pack your bags.
He can earn it. He just has a lot to prove.
Nope. Here's a cardboard box. Make room. Richard Iowati's on his way in for a screen test.
Oh, please.
I'm just going to keep throwing that name out there until the UK bookies start picking it up.
So next week we're going to be coming back with our Torchwood rewatch, and this is going to be the series finale for series 2. The episode Exit Wounds.
Right. So figure out how Gray is in John Hart's hands and
spectrally.
Yes. The Obi-Wan version of John Hart. So we got a good tee up on the last episode for Fragments. and now we get to see how this is going to land for Jack having to deal with his past again in full view of his team.
Right.
So he's going to have to own up to some of his past to his team, who he've kept so much in the dark up until now. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. Peak Torchwood.
P-I-Q-U-E, yeah, not P-E-E-K.
It's actually peak, P-E-A-K, peak, P-I-Q-U-E. So it's peak peaking.
But we're not peaking.
No, you can't. You can't peek ahead to the peak peak. I'm sorry for this entire episode.
Well, this has been episode 423 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying it's a lot like, you know, podcasting is a lot like visiting Paris. You can't just read the guidebook. You've got to throw yourself in, eat the food, use the wrong verbs, get charged double, and end up kissing complete strangers. Or is that just me?
And this is Kier saying, Adam's an ass. Adam's an ass.
This is Julie saying, I can't wait to go to Bomina's birthday parties.
And this is Haley saying, to all future employers, I will accept birthday drinks in lieu of cake.
We'll see you next week.
I'm Ozzy.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Want to keep the conversation going? You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Or just send us a good old-fashioned email to feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. You can also give us a phone call at 754-225-5477. That's 754-CALL-GPR, and you may hear your voice on a future episode of the show. Everything's got to end sometime, otherwise nothing would ever get started. Join us next week for a brand new episode.
Jacob Hansen. Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2021. We'll see you next week.
What? Fuck all y'all. Are you ready to shut up now?
Okay, I forgot what we were here for.
It's okay, it was a forgettable episode.
Oh, jeez. All right.